The lecture that Dr. Marnie has been giving this morning has moved from Johnson 206 to the snack shop, and it's now here. Kind of a wandering person, so we've been following all morning. He'll be speaking after the special music by Phyllis Mayo. He'll be speaking for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then he'd like to throw it open to what's important to the people who are here. So Dr. Marnie, for those who don't know, it works at Lake Junaluska Interpreter's House. It's a place for, I guess, basically ministers who are in crisis to come and try to sort things out. He's a writer, several books, such as Preach to Each Other, which is in the bookstore if you wish to pursue some of his thinking. Also, a preacher and a teacher, and he's teaching at Duke in the spring on a preaching course, which is offered there. So after Phyllis, Dr. Marnie will come and lead the final of this morning's lecture.
I was very glad to have the invitation for this morning, a year or so ago from your people. I believe this is the third time, the third generation of college people I've had the privilege of sharing such a time with here at Southeastern Seminary. I still miss seeing Sid Staley when I come. I'm glad I still run into Fred and Bob Persky. It's good to run into Lolly and to hear that you all are in business better than ever. I wish I might have heard John Edens last night on vocation. I'm sure he has taken Luther with proper seriousness. For vocatio is a terrific word in Martin Luther. So is vocation a fantastic word in the life letters of St. Paul. And I should like to have heard John Edens' version of the calling that rests upon us all. Indeed, the opening line in your program, God calls people to all vocations, is a kind of redundancy one finds in St. Paul. I once heard Buttrick do it at Harvard. He said, you'd better be careful coming to church here. You might have hands laid upon you to apprehend you for that for which you have already been apprehended of God. The way St. Paul puts it is, I, Paul, call you alongside the calling with which you are already called. Consequently, I was almost in ecstasy one day at Cornell University to discover that my luncheon partner, the world's greatest expert on the 34 forms of cancer that destroy the common potato, considered himself a minister of the gospel of God. There are millions of people whose livelihood depends upon their potato surviving the forms of cancer that would destroy the crop. One is religious. One is under calling who works with retarded children. One is under God's calling who works with metal and steel, provided it comes to a human end and a human concern. One is under God's calling, whatever his gifts. Nevertheless, the word vocation has size. It ought not ever to have been appropriated by those who think they have the gift of gab and therefore go into the ministry. Vocation includes role. It includes work. It includes gifts. It's an overall word that covers one's sense of awareness. And perhaps this is why, since there are so many ways to serve the God of our lives, that I've been so particularly squeamish about either being called a prophet or thought of as one or being asked to talk about it. I find one's prophetic moments are few and far between, and that he doesn't stay long if he is one. Indeed, Christer Stendahl, now dean at Harvard Divinity School some years ago at a lovely party, in the shank of the evening, bent over to say to me, no prophet ever has a salary, and this is so. Don't count on being paid for your prophecies. My reluctance, however, has not been against being a prophet. It's against seeing you turn into pastors, because God knows we've made so many of us who are utterly inept. God knows so many have used God Almighty to to checkmate a mama or a daddy who was overwhelmingly powerful in their lives, and how else can you get out from under an overweening mother without going a notch higher and using God? How else can you dispose of a father who is determined that you be a lawyer when you don't want to be a lawyer without claiming to be called? Now, of course you're called, but the question resolves itself for me into, what is your gift? What are your gifts? What are your special gifts? This determines where one works. Only God himself knows what grief I have endured with people who were victims of premature precision. I remember a darling woman in Charlotte, Robin will remember her, who came to me during one of our serious inquiries in this direction to say that she was convinced God had called her to leave 3 children and her husband and go to Louisiana and tell Bible stories up and down the bayou. Well, one looks under chips like that, and there wasn't anything that wrong with the marriage, and her children weren't that malicious and devilish, and life was not this dull, but I found it finally. She's 12 years old, and some stupid evangelist lets a 12-year-old child get too specific in her little girl fantasies of where she could go and what she could do for God 20 years before she'd have a chance to make a genuinely competent, independent decision about where she ought to serve God. I've listened to many a lovely high school teacher frustrated beyond endurance for 30 years because the Foreign Mission Board didn't take her after she was allowed to get too foolishly specific about China when she wasn't equipped for China or the Congo. I've known marriages put under unbearable strain by this premature precision. What can one decide then? One can decide to follow opportunity, light, new chance, according to her, according to his gifts, under the will of God. But we ought not to be acquiring this premature precision, for who knows what will be. This is why I've rejoiced more than any other single change, except certain personnel changes in a Foreign Mission Board. I've rejoiced over this new program that lets you go 6 weeks, 8 weeks, a summer, 2 months, 4 years. A man ought to be able to fail and come home without having to carry it as a shadow or a cross on his back for 30 years. He ought to be allowed to know that sacrament of failure, for failure is not God's failure. Failure is a sacrament. And to put a square peg in anything other than a square hole will produce an excruciating sacrament. You just may not be able to call it such. So I wish to speak first against premature precision, but my particular reluctance all my adult years has been to participate in Baptist ordinations. Of all the things we are equipped to do as congregations, ordination may be where we are most vulnerable, where it's most dangerous, and where we ought to proceed most reluctantly. Indeed, the congregation has authority to do this. It snatched Ambrose of Milan and turned him from a professor of rhetoric into a bishop. It dragged Augustine into consecration as a bishop. Little Mountain congregation decided months before George Truett would submit to it that he was to be ordained. It's a competent authority, but we ought to come at it carefully. And there are 5 questions I keep raising about me. And I keep raising about all those 56 wonderful youngsters I get to share with at Duke this semester, 5 hours a week. I keep asking it about anyone who wants to talk with me about ministry. And it's why I've been so reluctant to participate in that actual dreadful laying on of hands. I can sometimes do it with great gladness, though, as I told one of the seminars, I suppose as conference preacher, guest conference preacher, I've participated in the ordination of 100 Methodists, but I don't mind that. I'd rather they'd be one of theirs than one of ourn. and I don't have to raise my five questions with them. But with me, or with us, or as I'm doing right now in a very hard-pressed way, I've been asked, well, Hans Kuhn is doing the lectures at Riverside Church next October in honor of the 100th anniversary of Harry Emerson Fosdick's birth. And I'm doing the Protestant lectures over at Union Seminary next month, and I have to go first. And I'm raising five questions about Fosdick. They're the same five I raise about me. One, can this person, can she bless her origins? Can he have come to some kind of peace with where he's from? I didn't say, could he go back? I can't. It's been 30 years since the church in Tennessee would call me. But I can go back through. And when I go home, I am gladly and proudly Leonard's boy. And I'm Sadie's boy. And it's all right to be this. Now, I knew that much, much, much earlier. What I didn't know was that a person who can't bless her beginnings, I didn't say like them. I didn't say approve them. I didn't even say want to continue them. I do say, a person who can't bless the pit from which he is digged, to use King James English, can't bless anything or anybody else. So most of our work at Interpreter's House for 3 weeks at a time has been trying to help older men and women come to some kind of terms with the forces that shaped and misshaped them to where they can bless their origins, or as dear Eric Erickson puts it somewhere, coming to at least where I can let be. I didn't say let go. That's an amputation. I did say I can let it be. And when I can let it be, I'm no longer so vulnerable to trying to sound like a prophet because I'm so blooming mad at my daddy. I no longer am so vulnerable to being angry over issues that aren't the issue. I'm no longer victim of that transference that sees every powerful person in my congregation as either a threat or an enemy. I can come at it with some maturity. Second question I have to raise swiftly now, if I'm going to give you time, is can this person damn bad religion? I believe the most single shortcoming of contemporary ministry is our stupid notion that if just one gets right, everything's going to be okay. I kept three psychiatrists reasonably busy for 6 months after Billy Graham's last meeting closed in Charlotte. And my heart was on the side of those who had heard themselves promised something which, if they would submit, would be present, and it wasn't there. The faithful word against bad religion is a mark of integrity in ministry that's hard to come by. I recommend to you great Archbishop William Temple's version of it in his Gifford Lectures when he says, there's really no argument that much more harm has been done than good in this world by bad religion. And one of the first marks of legitimate faith is that it will recognize bad religion in terms of what its faithful service will do to persons. Bad religion is not going to do anything to God Almighty. He's reasonably safe from our assaults. But oh my God, what it can do to human beings. How it can distort A young man here just inveighed to me this morning against a frontline varsity pastor who stupidly told his own mother to drop a certain medicine. She no longer needed it if she believed in God and loved the Holy Spirit. How incompetent can one get, and it ought to be spoken against, which implies a certain second level theological competency. That means I know good religion when I hear it and when I run into it, which means, is this person who goes into ministry, has he already hung all his hooks up, or is he able to be learning all his life? And is he able to run into theologians everywhere, 2 years old or less? Lord, what that little fellow who named me Marnie McCubbin. McCubbin was his last name, and it was one of the great honors of my life to be called Marnie McCubbin by a little McCubbin boy dying of leukemia who taught my whole congregation a great deal about love, and he was barely 2 years old and half dead. One needs to be able to run into his theologians everywhere, but to know the good from the bad. And again, I have to ask of Fosdick, or of you, or of me, across any 10-year span, did, does, or will this person's ministry stand over against, cut in on, and bless or damn? As Julian Hart at Yale used to put it, a God who can't damn can't bless. Does his yes and her no, does her yes, no, cut over against the grain of the tent poles that hold up the teepees of the culture where he or she is working? Now, whether it's South Mississippi, as we were talking earlier, or Northern Wisconsin, the poles of the teepee will be the same. First assignment I give youngsters at Duke is to bring me 8 lines each that will tell me what they think their people really think about sex, race, region, religion, politics, class, economics, family, play. What holds up their tent? And my ministry across any 10-year span should have cut into and blessed or strengthened or cursed or grappled with these gods, these household gods the people use to prop up their teepee. Of course, if he's smart, if she's as sharp as a snake while being harmless as a dove, she won't grab any 2 of them on Sunday. Just 1 of them. And she certainly won't mess that economics one up with that race one unless she plans to move on Monday. The only time I was ever visited by a committee asking me never to have a man back again, it was Clarence Jordan. It was Myers Park Church. They didn't want no more of that fella. Clarence died before I could have him back. He would whoop you over pacifism. I never saw so belligerent a pacifist. And I loved him dearly. Clarence didn't make any mistakes. So he came from an old Georgia banking family, so he naturally would interrupt the economics. And I had 12 bankers and 2 undertakers on the front row to take up the offering. It just, it works better that way to use. And when Clarence said you could embalm an elephant for 90 cents, what do you people want with a $4,000 funeral? That blew it. I'm saying you don't interrupt that sex one and that race one on the same Sunday if you're smart. And really, you do your interruption more as a person sent to teach. Because if I were doing it over, I'd recognize how much my angers had to do and frustrations had to do with my so-called prophetic moments. and I'd ask deeper questions. I think I could pass them, but I would ask deeper questions about my priesting, which would mean, did I really know my own name? At least could I hear it when you told me my name is Jesus? That's my species. It wouldn't mean I assume that name. It would mean I could hear it when it happened between us. And I would be asking, do I know the words of consolation? I've helped 150 men, a refugee out of the South. Those who left frequently have raised our average by departing. It wasn't because they didn't speak a faithful word on race that they had to pull out. It was because they had not known the words of consolation that would have let them speak a faithful word on anything and stay. My great teacher here, I'll love him till I die, was J.P. Weatherspoon, whom you had the joys of having here. In his older years, I had him in his prime, 6 years of him, and am grateful for him. The words of consolation, and what are they? My current teacher is Flannery O'Connor. What a theologian, that little Roman Catholic raiser of peahens and peacocks in South Georgia, has proven to be for me. When on her own, nearing her own deathbed from lupus, I've seen two lupus deaths. I hope I never see another. But Flannery O'Connor was already far along with lupus when she said in a lecture, which I have taped, healing is sometimes just not a possibility, but grace is always present to me. One does not know the words of consolation until he knows that healing and grace are two different things. And until he knows that most divine healers, so called, neither term really applies. But most divine healers, so called, and most positive thinkers, so called, have missed the agonizing point of the meaning of suffering and grief and pain and despair and illness. They do not know these situations bear grace in their wings, whether healing is a possibility or not. This, in essence, then, are the five questions I'd ask before I'd ordain anybody. Does this young person show a capacity? I don't say has she, he arrived here yet. I've been working at it 40 years. There are days when it's okay. There are days when I have to start all over because my cellar side comes up on me from the rear, always from the rear. Maybe that's why Erickson makes so much of the back end in therapy. Maybe that's why Kierkegaard talks of thoughts that wound from behind. But I ask, are you showing signs of being able to bless your pappy and your mammy? At least let them be. You don't have to go home to fix them. And God knows if my children could quit fixing me. Susan was 9 when she told me it took a lot of forgiveness to be my daughter. I tried to start letting her go so we could be colleagues, but I find it wasn't what I intended, it's how she read what I intended that did all the damage. Can I bless my origins to where I can see hope for others' origins? Or as Stuart Henry at Duke puts it, in the army of the Lord, everybody's wounded. And I've seen many more young blacks and whites who've become great by the way they coped with what seemed a bad set of origins than I've seen made great by the way they coped with perfect origins. How does she, he handle the origins? Do they know bad religion when they run into it, and therefore are they theologians? Are they able to speak the word against cultural idols without being destroyed in the hullabaloo that follows when I do it? Are they arriving at a sense of identity that equips us to do and be the words of consolation, knowing that no one can utter a word of consolation to another which he himself, she herself, has not herself heard? There is no general word of consolation. It's always a specific word to a specific hearer. It doesn't mean all of us have to have had our loved ones die before we can hold a funeral. But it does mean we have to be coming to terms with what we have lost. And anyone who survived has lost. And anyone who is still alive has been blessed. Do you then know a great deal more about an original salvation than you do about original sin? Because if somebody picked you up, they figured you were worth keeping. And that equips you to become a hearer. Given these, there will then be moments when it's all right. I carried my resignation 2 years at Paducah, Kentucky, already signed. All it needed was a date. Praying every day for God to get me out of Paducah, with him laughing at me all the time. It's all right to come to the sharp corners. One can survive them if he's done his priesting, and if he has been priested, and if he's kept up with that private church that sustains him the whole journey through, regardless of what's going on in his village, and if he's learned already not to limit either his concerns or his work or his worth to the little congregation that's paying his way. If he has learned, as Wesley and Calvin both taught their young men to do, if he's learned to pray the prayer the Pope prays Christmas Eve from the balcony when he says, Urbe et Orbe, the city and the world. If he's learned that his parish and his little church membership are not coterminous terms, he can be pastor. And if I had it to do over, I'd do that again. I wouldn't divert myself into psychiatry, much as I'm indebted to that division. Carl Menninger wrote me some time ago to say, why don't you people get on with it? Why do you keep trying to practice psychiatry with or without fees when we don't know very much, really? Why don't you do your thing? And I had to answer him, dear doctor, most of the fellows we see haven't enough ego strength to damn a church mouse, much less a whole culture. And they are not able to submit to intimacies. And so we have to start where they are. They can't be Amos or Obadiah or Habakkuk or John the Baptist like you're asking them to be yet. Not without these five competencies. Given that, there'll be moments when I can make like Nahum, Habakkuk, and Obadiah on the same day, provided I don't expect to get paid for it. And provided I recognize what a sinner I am if I stayed overnight, but how impossible it would be to be pastor if I weren't willing also to be sinner. For the terms are synonymous. So it's too late to clean you up, to get you innocent. What I would hope for in a pastor then would be responsible guilt. That is to say, does she believe in grace, really? That's enough talking. What would you like to throw back? That's the way I would look at prophetic ministry. It has some pillars under it if it's genuine. Yeah. I don't mind saying it here because it came from Sidner Staley. I'm 23, he's 41. He's just come to Louisville to teach. Catches me in the hall, I'm just starting. I'd kind of waited for him to name a church history fella because that's what I wanted to do my work in. He said, big fella, ain't you? Got a smile and a gift of gab, gonna get up front. I was embarrassed. He said, don't be embarrassed. Won't it be hell when you get up there and haven't got anything to say? Forgive me, that was Staley. I'm quoting, I'm not creating. I said, well, doctor, I came here to measure with you. And he said, I'll take you if you'll take one oath. I said, what's that? He said, you'll have to promise me never to get in position where your denomination can give you what you have to have, or you'll pay too much for it. I began to learn then from Sid, who was an elder in my private church across the years, and my children's church and my wife's church, that one could not look to organizational or institutional sources for the kind of inner sustenance that would let him do work in organizations and institutions, huh? And I began to see during my seminary years how precious L.D. Johnson and Theron Price and Guy Ranson and Sid Staley and Carver, and I could go forever, were becoming to me, and how much I needed what Sandusky and fellow students were giving me. Now, 35, 40 years out, these are the girders that hold some kind of integrity together in a life's work, except I now know that some of those fellows I met in means patrologia latinum, or patrologia graecum, the writings of the fathers, are in my private church. Ambrose and Cyprian and Augustine, they've been dead 1,700 years. My daddy's been dead 6-7 years. Hughes, my great pastor's been dead since the mid-50s. These are private church people. People with whom I'm okay. Whether I'm right or wrong, my worth with them's not up for grabs. Are you hearing me? Private church, then, is those to whom I can give myself because they give themselves to me, they hear me, they establish me, they sustain me, they rebuke me, they fulfill all the functions that the book of Acts says the Holy Spirit would do to me. Rebuke, exhort, warm. Some even curse me. But what's between us is not up for market. Huh? And so one lives, moves, is aware each day of his life that he's being held together by these people. It wrecks individualism, huh? But it creates a capacity for personhood to be available and vulnerable and present, provided I don't close down the membership of my private church. I have to keep leaving room for little fellers of either sex to come in, and I have to keep leaving room on the balcony for some of them to get translated or just decide they don't want to be in my church no more. And I have to put up with some who don't know they're in my church. Huh? Have I answered? Do you hear me? Now, this is what sustains us. You'll find that it's extra-denominational, extra-institutional, but it lets me put up with and not miss the graces one runs into in the house. Because there are members of my private church in every congregation that let me stay a little while. There are one or two left there that I can go back and spend the night with. I think I've answered that all I know about it, but it might kick up something for some of the others. It does sustain one, I find. It's what Paul Ricoeur means when he says hope is the same thing as remembering. I don't like the new German theologians who claim that hope comes out of a vacuum from the future. I don't know what they're talking about. Hope rests on memory. Same thing fellowship rests on. And all our memory begins in the, I'm the Lord your God who brought you up. Out of from wherever he found us, it was up. And these memories of those we meet on the road sustain us and posit hope. Well, there's no reason to expect a high trust level here. We really don't know each other. But I swear before the eternal, I'll try to take your question or response or short sermon seriously, and I'll try not to embarrass me or you. There's as much, maybe more reason to go in ministry now than any time during my working life. You just don't assume you're somebody anymore because you got ordained. It's the lowest credit rating in the country next to plumbers and painters. And you don't assume, as Elizabeth says to me, you don't assume that you know where they ought to be before you got there. So a lot of being pastors waiting. And if you wait long enough, you'll have a chance to be a prophet. Yes, sir. Mr. Prickett, isn't it?
That's right. Suppose we're well along the road at going where we think we've been supposed to go, but we have this terrible gnawing feeling or sudden realization we're not where we ought to be. And we've already committed ourselves, and we have to work up too much pride and the momentum we've got. But what kind of personal therapy or what should we do if we discover we're in the wrong place?
I wanted to come to your seminar because you were talking about where I think it's at on this whole vocational topic, and that is that there are lots of ways to be. I would begin with such a person by trying to pick up the edges of that dark feeling that I'm not where I ought to be or where I'm supposed to be. And I began to look at how that person puts a direct object on a verb that won't take a direct object. The verb to be is not a to be where or a to be what. The verb to be is generally a to be who. And the who is the subject of the verb, not the object of the verb. And so I would try to ask this person, from what are you trying to derive your sense of being worthy or important, or where you're supposed to be, so to be. I'd come at it like you were coming at it. What gifts do you bring to this enterprise that let your proper title, call to be, happen? But it's not a call to be what, and it's not a called to be where, but the whatness and the whereness are determined by my gifts and my opportunities. But the call to be is a constant. And I'd be trying to help him or her take a look at that eye. For example, one or two of the better Episcopalian seminaries that I know have just been flooded by men in mid-career crisis. Now, some of it's legitimate. It's perfectly okay to have put in 20 years in the Navy, take a good fat retirement as commander, and go to seminary. It means you won't be vulnerable to people. You've got your own income. You can just raise old Billy. They can fire you, and you can still preach right on because you're drawing $800 a month as a retired Navy commander. This is great. That's authentic. I like that one. But the man who's moved from pillar to post, so to speak, and now may be making his fifth or sixth so-called vocational change, really needs to be heard in terms of that being rather than doing or having. Am I talking now where you're asking, Mr. Prick? Would you like to add anything here?
Or understanding of what to do just because they've realized
Yes.
Maybe they're in the wrong place. Then they don't know what to do about it.
Yes. And I've tried to hear several first-class varsity sixth grade or junior high school teachers into a better awareness of what they're up to as priests of God, instead of ordaining them into some shirt-tail Baptist congregation that doesn't really want them. I've tried to spread this notion that gift really does determine calling, and that one is not above another, and that a man, a woman may serve God, will serve God with wherever, whoever, which is incidental. It's the calling that's, it's the having heard the horn blow that puts the church together in the ancient scriptures, but it's the same thing. It puts us to work. But you don't put a, you may put a carpenter to building coffins, but you don't try to use his carpenter gifts to run a dairy. He'd mess up a lot of good cows. Yes, sir?
Say a word about the future of these very gifted and wonderful young women who would be definitely called to be a pastor.
Well, my experience with them, I can't talk about their future, and I wouldn't blame them for quitting, because Lord knows they run through every barbed wire fence that we can put up. But the future, I don't know about. The present is exciting to me. I have 10 of the sharpest of this kind now in third-year courses at Duke, and they're tough, and they've been to school, and they're open, and they know what they're going to run into. I said, not quite facetiously, I think if I were a woman pastor, I'd consider the Methodist Church, but not for its district superintendents, somebody pointed out. They're idiots, too. Here and there are rare exceptions. But I would put myself under an authority pattern that has been forced to make room for me and feel like I had a little more room to live, maybe, than under the congregational call system, unless my daddy owned land at about 5 places in the same region, so that I'd know I could get moving around a little. If I ran into trouble here, I could move over here. My point here being that Free Church, I'm talking about United Church, one of my brightest friends of the female persuasion, just been fired from her very first job in less than 3 months by a hard-headed group of deacons that in the United Church are responsible for who's pastor. They had the power. She's out. The only reason I mention Methodist is that 30, 40, 50 of the Methodist bishops that I've known, no, they've got to come clean on this. And you have at least that umbrella. 5, 6, 8 of the women in West Virginia who are doing first-class jobs up and down those hollows as pastors are under Methodist appointment, full members of the conference, ordained elders, doing first-class work and respected as such. Now, the American Baptists have ordained women over 100 years. Our record's going to be much better. Baptists south of God are going to do better. But we give about as little protection to a pastor as any outfit I know. Our system, in some ways, is as bad as the worst. It's also as good as the best, if things are right. But you're vulnerable. They know this and don't need a fly by night like me passing through to tell them. But they're going to do all right, doctor. They're going to do all right. It's an authentic and legitimate calling, and the highest grades I've given for a certain kind of preaching, I teach only 1 2-hour thing in that, but there's one young man pastor in this state who will hate me till I die because I gave his wife the highest grade in the class and gave him one of the lowest ones, and he's bearing it like a cross all the way to Calvary. But she was that much better. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
How do you
Oh, I'm not recommending that seriously, but if the women escape, you've put it well. I didn't use that word. You are making an implication there. I am not willing to be judged as implying. I would call it an option for immediate ministry, because in any congregationally governed church, instead of any social issue, sex, race, region, religion, politics, economics, and it's to our credit, I think, coming down from commission, it has to work its way up through the grains of sand. And it means that a congregationally ruled constituency always runs the risk of being 500-600 years out of date, because our social insights depends upon it having reached everybody and having become commonly held opinion before it's permissible. And where my ordination depends on a unanimous vote of an ordaining council and a majority vote, at least, of the congregation, my ordination's in the hands of people who just may not be competent to decide on my calling. So for the sake of my ministry, if I run into this, I'm pointing out an option. But by the same token, it's why we have lagged so every legislature, every country club, nearly, every police department, and every county judge had to move on race before any of the congregations I've served had to move. And I was vulnerable at that point. I could only move as fast as my slowest, who were contributors, would go. And that's vulnerability. It's in our system. It presupposes that everybody will be responsible, and I'm for that. It presupposes a growing people, and I'm for that. And I grant you quickly that for it to come down by the power of a bishop won't make you pastor. You're sent, but you don't get to be pastor till they let you in. But I'm talking about people now. I know one master's degree graduate of this seminary who's living in a convent in central Kentucky. There's not a Baptist congregation in Kentucky that'll take her. She's been to school here, California, Union Seminary, published 2 volumes of poems, and is a remarkable human being. But I don't know a church in Kentucky that'll touch her. She's been all over the state. She's living in a Roman Catholic convent, teaching retarded children. That's okay. But that's why I made that remark. No use brushing it off, but I don't draw a dime from these people, so I'm right free to talk. You're here to correct me, though, when I go too far, and I'll submit. But I think I've not been unfair to the experience of young women with whom I correspond. Didn't know it. I certainly didn't know anywhere to send that carol that the United Church had treated the way it did. I didn't have any recommendations to make. Didn't know any quarter-time Baptist church in North Carolina hunting a female woman pastor. Do you? We'll catch up, though. We're nice people. We'll be ahead of them Catholics still. And the poor Episcopalians can't even rewrite their prayer book, much less ordain women. Oh, you can get an awfulest fight in the Diocese of Atlanta over the language of the prayer book. It's a cop-out to keep from facing the real issues. Us Baptists got no more sense than just to face the issue and say, join somebody else, honey. See, we dispose of people. We can eat a pastor up in 3 months. Does that sound threatening? No, they won't do you that way in Mississippi. They're nicer about it down there. But where these women are, meeting receptivity. What? It's first class. It's just no question about it. Incidentally, a friend and colleague of mine, Helen was first my friend when she was minister to students at the great University of South Carolina Women's Campus down below Charlotte, has just done a book of first-class preaching. I mean, it's just first-class. I believe Fortress Press, I believe, brought it out, and it's a dozen or so women, sermons by women that are just first-class. I've forgotten its title, but it's probably in the bookstore. If they didn't know Helen as a woman, she's one of the ministers over at Duke. Helen Crotwell is the editor. Sermon in there by Rosemary Ruther is just worth the whole book. Anybody else raise? I don't know what our time is, boss man. You'll have to blow the whistle on me. Are there other comments or exchanges you'd like to make? Yeah.
Can grace be severe?
Dr. Sandusky raises the question that through Dr. Staley, who first put Nikolai Berdyaev in my hands, and to have that gift from a teacher was worth 4 or 5 years. Berdyaev says suffering is unto life or unto death. And whether it's one or the other is frequently in the hands of the sufferer. Now, suffering which may or may not be severe mercy is made into a mercy, seems to me, Fred, by the way I see its meaning and purpose and end. Hence, Berdyaev could go on to say, anywhere a good man, woman suffers, redemption is released to the surrounding need. This is what the so-called faith healers miss. But now, whether or not its severity and its mercy are connected or not, I don't know this yet. Because God knows I have not needed some of the stuff I've had to learn what I learned. I could have learned it lots cheaper. And yet I'm reminded of a thing you and I may both have heard Buttrick say when we were young. God had rather see the flesh broke, the bones broke, and the flesh plowed than to see man, species, miss destiny. And I think Buttrick was implying that the divine mercy would lay it on us at whatever weight it took to change direction. He wouldn't just see us fritter away. I don't know whether I'm talking. I do know this, that the severities I've dealt with have not seemed merciful. And that sometimes I have to wait. And that I'm not one of those fellows who can say with any satisfaction, you just wait, something good will come out of this. It's just not so, necessarily. Severe mercy. Whose phrase is that? Is that yours? I hadn't seen it. Sounds like him. Yeah. Well, I intend that sincerely. Yes, he would see this. I want to thank you for a most gracious hearing, and I want to express the hope that my being candid about ministry may not be the best way to say how committed I am to it, or why I have stayed with it. And it's none of your business how I answered my own dear mother the last time I was home when she wouldn't let me come in the house because I was wearing a beard. We'd been in Europe for several months, and Mama wouldn't let me in the house, made me sit on her front porch, and told the neighbors I was getting ready for a part in a Bible play, she thought. Because God knows neither one of her boys, you know, would. But this was her question, and I raise it in order to try to answer again what the question that you were raising a moment ago. Mother said to me, "What are you doing since you left the ministry?" And I had tenderly to tell her, "My God, Mama, I'm in a ministry that bleeds and cries and smells. And I'm up to my ears in the most fatiguing work I've ever done. And I can't call it leaving the ministry. I just wish the Southern Baptist Retirement Fund had the same look at it." Because I don't like it that I've got to work for a Baptist church or a Baptist institution before I can contribute to that. It's the only real reason why I pay mine into American Baptists. They have a little broader notion of whom we have to support. So I'm for all them blacksmiths and telephone operators and Sunday school people and board people and all these others. And I remember particularly Frank Davis, a magnificent heavy tractor operator on top of our mountains, who can just lay a blade along like a razor where you wouldn't think a cat could walk. Frank steps down off his tractor and says, "That feller in that Southern Baptist church down there in Amos Holler, he ain't doctrine right, using the old mountain notion of doctor to teach. He ain't doctrine right on some of them doctrines." And I said, "Frank, what do you think he ought to be saying?" And he'd tell me, and more often than not, it's authentic. God does get to common folks who run tractors. And I remember an old man who used to drive cattle through the Smokies teaching me how wrong all those Southern Baptists were who taught me that Baptists never use the word sacrament, when he said in Elizabeth's kitchen one day, "My mommy," talking about 1870 now, "my mommy never missed the sacraments." The sacraments. It was a common Baptist mountain term for the Lord's Supper. Long before we got folks smart enough to tell us that wasn't one of our words. So I still trust those common theologians God's laid his hand on. And I'm grateful one of them was my father, to whom I never took a New Testament passage that I didn't get light. And I think he never saw a Greek Testament except the one I was trying to show off with and couldn't half read.